We recently asked a couple hundred of you emerging biotech leaders about your go-to sources of information when you face tough professional challenges. Your top response wasn't webinars, it wasn't scientific journals, it wasn't trade shows, it wasn't even consultants. Far and away, you said you most often turn to your peers for trusted insight. Enabling a community of peers is what the Business of Biotech podcast is all about. It's also what our new Business of Biotech newsletter is all about. Peer-driven content, no strings attached, delivered to your inbox once a month. Go to bioprocessonline.com/BOB to subscribe. The Business of Biotech is produced by Bioprocess Online, part of the Life Science Connect community, with support from Cytiva. Cytiva also demonstrates its commitment to the leaders of new and emerging biopharma at cytiva.com/emerging biotech. Check that out.
Welcome back to the Business of Biotech. I'm Matt Piller, and this episode finds me back in one of my favorite biotech sleeper towns, the city of bridges, the city of steel, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This city has brought us episodes with Ligenesis, BlueSphere, Nubase Therapeutics, and more. And today it finds us on Sydney Street visiting with a company called Peptologics and its founder, president, and CEO, Dr. Jonathan Stackbeck. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
It's our pleasure. So I want to start with you in a chronology that doesn't make any sense to me, just because I try to be a linear thinker. Sometimes I'm not, but you wrapped up your BS in microbiology at Penn State.
Yes.
Then you earned an MBA at Pitt.
Correct.
And then, at Pitt, you developed a framework for a market model accounting for the effects of direct-to-consumer advertising on pharmaceutical market diffusion, which you can explain that to me in a minute. But after that MBA, then you earned a PhD in biochem from Pitt. So
yes.
The chronology is a little bit confusing, and it's not easy for me to like look at all that and go, oh, clearly he knew at X point where he wanted to go with his career. So just break that down.
Sure. So try to walk through it as linearly as possible, given that it is a little kind of out of sync with what is typically seen, right? And so kind of if you go back before my bachelor's at Penn State, over a couple of summers while I was in school, I had interned at a biotech in the Columbia, Maryland area. And what I saw there was that while scientists get to do the really cool work, they don't always get to make the decisions about what work gets done. And so, you know, I knew, and I've been always, you know, interested in science ever since I was a kid. But that was kind of the first piece of evidence that if you really want to have an impact, you've probably got to think a little bit broader than just the science, right? So so at that point, I graduated college, worked for a couple of years I moved to Pittsburgh and then worked at the medical school doing research in HIV, trying to understand the immune response and how we could design – if we could understand the immune response, could we design better vaccines to it? After a few years of that, had the opportunity to go back and get an MBA because that was kind of really the if you want to have a bigger impact, you've got to learn the language of business. And that was kind of the easiest way or the fastest way I could figure to do it, just in the construct of kind of where I was at the time.
Yeah.
And then after that, then I went back to the university, ran one of the profit centers. So I ran one of the core facilities there. And then after a couple of years, a couple of things happened. So one was I had been working on HIV, and then in like 2005, my father-in-law got admitted to the hospital and ended up dying from an infection. And so that, you know, background in microbiology and kind of a bunch of lab work really crystallized this idea of antibiotic resistance being a problem.
Yeah.
Right. It's always it can have been like an esoteric problem, never personally affecting. That was, you know, really crystallized that. So then, having been in Pittsburgh for a few years and knowing that I wanted to do something kind of entrepreneurial, and just understanding that there's a ton of great research that goes on here, but there, you know, at the time there wasn't a culture around taking it out, right? Like, so taking that and translating the work out. And so I looked at doing a PhD as an opportunity to have somebody to be, pay me essentially to do technical diligence on something. And so I entered the PhD program probably a little bit differently than most people. Mm-hmm. But then, and kind of it's culminated with where we are today.
Yeah.
We'll probably dig into some of that.
Dig into that a little bit.
But just chronologically, that's kind of how we got from, hey, take those disparate pieces and put them together in a way that at least made sense to kind of my progression.
Yeah. And I don't want to spend a ton of time here, but I'm curious about that. So when you went after the MBA, mm-hmm. coming out of, a science background, and like as I noted, the PhD probably would have been a more logical kind mm-hmm. of chronology of things. When you went after that MBA, was it difficult for your science brain to say, you know what, I'm going to shift gears here and learn the business? And so two-part question. One, was that a difficult transition? And two, was the intent in the back of your head at that point, like, I'm going to chase down the MBA because at some point I want to be a founder. I want to found something.
Yeah. So that's so I can start with that. Yeah. That was the idea, is again, trying to understand if you want to do science and actually have real impact, you've got to take it through a business.
Yeah.
And then for a difficulty, I would say, the hardest thing was kind of learning a different language, because mm-hmm. that's really all it is. If you think about, business, it can be very analytical, right? Yeah. And so a lot of what you do in science is similar to what you do in business, just the terminology is different and maybe the specific applications are different, but a lot of it's analytical. So it wasn't technically that difficult, but learning the language, that took a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. It's a challenge I think that a lot of scientific founders face. Would you recommend, like, if you are advising your younger brother-in-law, right? Assuming you like your younger brother-in-law, if you were advising him coming out of a science education, would you advise the MBA? Is that something that you?
So I probably would not, and I actually I do occasionally talk to graduate students. At different places. And not that there's anything inherently wrong with it. And maybe it's a little bit different now, but really the MBA or an MBA is, or has traditionally been, more geared to progressing in a larger company.
Yeah.
If you're working in a kind of startup environment, my general recommendation is just join a startup.
Oh, so you'd say join a startup and get a feel for it before you go try to launch your own.
Or do that too. Do one of those two things, but don't necessarily, I don't think having an MBA is a prerequisite.
Yeah. Now, you say, or do that too, it's sort of a bold statement to make, but you had, I don't want to call it a luxury because that would make it sound easy, but you came out of your PhD and pretty much formed up Peptologic as a result of that, right?
Yes.
So the transition was natural. It wasn't like you're like, oh, well, I'm going to found something. What should I start?
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about that. Like, give me the origin story on Peptologic.
Yeah. So it's kind of all ensconced in the name, if that makes sense. So it's kind of a two-part, right? So it's Peptologic, so peptide. So we're focused on peptide drugs, peptides mm-hmm. being small little proteins. I know the audience understands that, but just for those who may not.
Yeah.
And then the logic part was really around the way we approach arriving at the drugs. And it's really a design-based approach. And so where that comes from is, so our lead molecule, which we'll get into, it's called PLG0206. I'm just going to call it 206 because that's less of a mouthful for either of us.
Mm-hmm.
Was a molecule that – so it's a designed peptide. And the reason we ended up designing it was maybe just a little bit of backstory. And that,
well, yeah. So backstory, and you tell me whether this is a logical way to present it, because I want to understand the therapeutic potential of mm-hmm. of peptides in general. So maybe that ties in with what you're going to say, but if that's a precursor to the story you're going to tell me, let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, that can be either way. But so peptides, we're interested in peptides because we think of them in the context of kind of the three major or traditional drug modalities. So small molecules, peptides, biologics.
Mm-hmm.
they sit right in this middle space where nobody really understands it very well, right?
Yeah, so you're gonna stand out, by the way, on this podcast because it's like one of these things doesn't look like the other one game. Like I cover like 99% exclusively, if you can say it mm-hmm. that way. Like totally large molecule biologics. So, you know, when I thought, oh yeah, let's go down and talk to peptologics, I'm like, they're kind of fringe, right?
Well, yeah. So I think So the reason we focus on peptides, maybe just to kind of condense this down, is that among the three major drug modalities, you can think about kind of we think about it as a 2x2 matrix. So for a drug to be successful, you need kind of access, you need to be able to get to your target, and you need specificity. And so if you think about small molecules, traditionally they have really great access, right? They can get wherever they need to get to. That's why they've been so successful. Mm-hmm. But there are some specificity challenges. They're small molecules and they're a little more promiscuous than some other things.
Yeah.
Biologics, on the other hand, kind of flip that around. They are incredibly specific. Mm-hmm. But they do have challenges about getting everywhere they need to get to. So we look at kind of peptides as being this like potential Goldilocks, right? They kind of bring together. So if you think of that 2x2, if you can figure out some of the challenges, which I'll go through in a second, they actually can fit in that top, kind of top right, because they can have better access, right? They can get kind of distribute through the body well, if you can address PK challenges, and they can get intracellularly, right? Mm-hmm. But because they're biological polymers, they're just small proteins, essentially, right? They bring that specificity. So we're built around the idea that if we can solve some of the traditional challenges, mostly PK, and can you get them kind of inside cells, they actually might be the best drug modality. Now, that's a big, bold statement. And, you know, we're not the first person, you know, kind of the first group working on that. But I think the approach that we're taking, you know, will allow us to get towards solving that a little bit better.
Yeah. Just real quick on that. Who regulates peptides? Like at the FDA, how's that handled from a regulatory?
Yeah, so structure? We're mostly focused on the CDER side.
Yep. Okay. Cool.
That's its own thing too. Is like what actually is a peptide?
Well, it's, yeah,
like that's what I think by definition it's 40. If it goes bigger, then it could be a biologic, right? So it's an interesting area.
It is an interesting area. And I mean, as you know, it's an area that continuously challenges me. I get pitches all the time from companies that, you know, sometimes it's super clear to make the determination, not a fit. Other times, not so much, you know? And I ask people who are way smarter than I am about it. And they're like, hey, I can't figure it out either, right? So I appreciate that. You guys, I understand, are using some pretty high tech machine learning, artificial intelligence to aid your drug discovery program. So tell me about that.
We do. So, and really that is kind of the natural culmination of how we got to 206. So I assume we'll come back to that at some point mm-hmm. because that leads nicely into why we've ended up applying that. That technology. So maybe if I'll just briefly kind of talk about 206.
Yep.
So 206, it's an engineered peptide. So we designed the sequence. And the reason we designed the sequence is because it's the drug class that it's in. So it's broadly representative, or it sits in this class called antimicrobial peptides. So these molecules were discovered in the 1980s, I think the first one. And then subsequently, we, you know, thousands of naturally occurring compounds. And at the time, they were hailed as the next big, like, this is going to be the next big class of antibiotics because a new thing, novel mechanism of action, this could be a way to kind of address, at the time, the kind of burgeoning antimicrobial problem, although antibiotics, you know, have that under control or had it under control at the time. Well, over the intervening kind of 30 or 40 years, the challenge has often been that those molecules that look promising in the lab, when you get them into the clinic, they're not so promising, right? They've all had challenges. A lot of the challenges were associated with tox, so tox problems. So what we were doing was trying to understand the structure activity of the molecules. So we started with a natural peptide and then started to make changes to see if we made this change here to the amino acids, what does it do to the activity? And we had a pretty good understanding of what that looked like. As we were following some of the molecules that had been progressing into the clinic and seeing where they were failing, in that tox issue, it was often associated with inflammation. And so we had a hypothesis that inflammation is usually a receptor-driven process, which means there's specificity involved. And so if we understand how to modulate the activity of the molecules, maybe we can design one with the properties that we want without any of the tox problems, right? To remove sequence specificity. And so that's what we did. We engineered 206. So it's a 24 residue peptide, only natural amino acids, all L, no special modifications. And it's sequenced in a specific way to give us the activity characteristics that we want, but to remove any of that potential to kind of kickstart an inflammatory response. Mm-hmm. And so the data there were good. That's when I started the company to really put that through it. Kind of a proper pharmaceutical development process.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll come to this, but we just finished enrollment in a 1B POC trial there. Now, started Peptologics kind of for two reasons though. One was to move that drug forward, right? If it looked good, we think there's a really huge need for what it can do. But as that molecule progressed, so as we, the animal studies were good, we didn't see any of the tox problems that have been traditionally associated with them. As the humans, so we put this in humans, didn't see any of the tox response, kind of the safety response that had been associated with the class. That gave us some confidence that this design-based approach could work. And so now, once we had that data, what we started to do was, as you mentioned, was, really using kind of modern machine learning, artificial intelligence, could we take that same idea? So if you think about 206, what we actually did was took pharmaceutical properties, so activity, safety, and try to encode it in the molecule itself. Now we want to be able to do that with any and all pharmaceutical properties. The best way we see to do that is to use some of the tools of technology, machine learning, artificial intelligence, to more broadly capture different biological activities, understand how they relate to molecular sequence and structure, to then be able to encode those properties at the beginning, rather than going through the iterative process of finding something that binds and then figuring out which one is, what's stable, what's soluble, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. When you say we are trying to do that, are you saying Peptologics is that sort of a separate effort that Peptologics is working on?
So it's one
say,
of the
we say we mean like we
we as generally. As a company, because I think one of the things, yeah, so it's Peptologics.
Yeah.
And so what we try to do is, I think, bring together one of the unique things I think that we bring together the space is an integrated team. So, the company started very drug development focused, right? We had 206, we needed to put that through a development program. So we built that capability. And then alongside that, now what we've been doing is bringing in more computationally minded folks to interface with the development folks, because we think the breadth and depth of kind of non-clinical and clinical information will be incredibly useful mm-hmm. to kind of feed to the computers so that they can understand the things or find the relationships between things that humans just can't find.
Yeah.
Because the scale and complexity is so vast.
Yeah. And that gets to a question about how that approach sort of looks in practice for Peptologics mm-hmm. on the day-to-day. So do you have wet labs and computational people kind of working arm in arm? And what does that kind of look like?
Yeah. So we don't have a fully functioning lab yet, because what we try to do is take the approach that we understand this is going to be very difficult and well, it could be. Mm-hmm. And, anybody can build a lab. But what really you need to be able to understand is, can you apply and find the right algorithms, the right techniques to actually make sense of the data that we already have, right? Because we're always, it doesn't matter what modality you work in, whether it's small molecules, peptides, large molecules. In biology, if you're using some of these techniques, you're always going to be disadvantaged relative to kind of tech, right? So if we think about the big thing in the news, ChatGPT, mm-hmm. right? So this was trained on the internet. The internet is incredibly vast and constantly expanding, almost like the universe, right? Biology is not quite that way. We don't have that type and extent of data. So what we really focused on was, can we develop algorithms, techniques, to make sense of the data that we do have and are likely to be able to get? Because if we can't do that, throwing more data at it isn't necessarily going to be useful. And so we spent a lot of effort, you know, our team led by Nick Nystrom, who used to run this Pittsburgh Supercomputing Center and is one of the world's real experts on bringing together kind of high performance computing and AI for life sciences broadly, was if we can bring together some of those tools and show that based on the data that do exist, we can make real kind of tangible progress and with relatively small data sets describe accurately the properties associated with those. We do that, then it makes sense to really apply and start to pour on a lot more data.
Yeah. How much of what's the ratio of like readily available tools to like proprietary development you guys have had to do?
Yeah, I'd say it's, let me think about this one. It's,
I mean, roughly. I'm just curious.
Yeah,
because you know, this is a nascent. I won't even say it's I guess it's more active than nascent, I think. But the I'm surprised, quite frankly, that there's not a larger sort of cottage industry of bio specific machine like software companies.
Yeah. And I think that's where we're going to have to go. So what we're finding, so to answer your question, I'd say, you know, probably 90 to 95% of what we do is ends up being proprietary. Mm-hmm. Partially because we don't believe and we haven't found. So we're relatively agnostic with what we, you know, if something exists and it's useful, we take that from tech, right? If it's sure. useful, we'll use it.
Yeah.
But what we found is, you know, I think relative to what we want to be able to do, kind of off-the-shelf algorithms aren't terribly useful. And I think that's even more so when applied to peptides, because again, kind of from a molecular standpoint, they're a little bit unique in that, again, they're not quite small molecules, a little bit bigger, a little bit more flexible, mm-hmm. kind of more complexity. And then on the other side, they're, you know, small-ish proteins, but they have some of their own unique attributes. And those unique attributes are important to be able to capture.
Yeah.
And so we've done a lot of work across kind of the computational spectrum. So not just in machine learning and, you know, AI broadly, but also in kind of more traditional things like molecular dynamics simulations to be able to really capture as effectively and accurately as possible the specific kind of attributes associated with peptides.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to get back to sort of the origin of the indication mm-hmm. that you pursued. You mentioned yeah. your father-in-law. I'm sorry to hear about that, by the way. But that was that sort of a inspirational, if you will, in terms of the indication that you determined you wanted to yeah. found a company around?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that was a kind of a crystallizing moment where
yeah.
this idea of antibiotic resistance was something I certainly read about in college. We had classes on it. In the lab, you use it, right? You use antibiotic resistance as a tool to kind of create the clones that you want, right? Mm-hmm. And this was, you know, the first point at which it became like a real personal thing. And so if you just took one step back and started to think about almost from a first principle standpoint about, okay, if you know, if bugs can be resistant to the drugs that we have, what does that mean? Well, evolutionarily, like things only usually go in one direction, right? So this isn't going to get any better.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's not and hasn't, right? I mean, from depending on who I talk to, like some of the stories that I hear about AMR mm-hmm. Are pretty doom and gloom. I mean,
yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I think I don't think it's controversial to say that AMR will become a really important issue for all of us. Because again, evolution pretty much goes in one direction, mm-hmm. right? And then the question or where controversy starts to come in is when, right? Because kind of clinicians and scientists have been saying AMR is going to be a problem forever, right? But it's always just like, it's just over there, right? It's tomorrow.
Yeah.
But I think we're starting to see more data is not the right word, although it is, that the infections that we used to be able to treat are much harder to treat, right? We're having to go deeper in the arsenal mm-hmm. for more people, Now, the challenge still remains that you go deep into the arsenal and you can cure most of those people, like, right, 95%. That sets up commercial challenges. And so, you know, to maybe bring it back to how we arrived at the indication. So we're, you know, we're not going after a traditional antibiotic indication. So, you know, most of the time, if you try to get an antibiotic approved, you do like a kind of urinary tract infection or intra-abdominal infection, because there's a clear regulatory pathway for those things. The challenge is that there's not a commercial market for those. And that's a whole separate thing. So I'm not sure that's the focus of where we want to get to.
So I'm going to ask you a question that is most likely going to make your PR and IR people nervous, because it'll invite forward-looking statements. But, you know, you can balk if you wish. So you've got this indication that you started with, periprosthetic joint infection.
You can just go PJI if you want.
PJI, okay. I had to look down at my notes. But so you got PJI, and PJI is one of, I don't know, like dozens and dozens, if not, you know, 100, I don't know, hospital-borne infections, or infections that people frequently get in hospitals or commonly get. And you mentioned that it was, you know, spurred by your father-in-law's experience, your experience with your father-in-law. And I think we all probably know people who have been impacted by infections in mm-hmm. the hospital in myriad different places of their body. My wife, shortly after she had my daughter, was hospitalized with pneumonia, and she was in the hospital for an extended stay for a blood infection. She had sepsis, and it was very serious. I mean, it was really touch and go there for a little bit, and she was vigorous and healthy when she went mm-hmm. into the hospital, with the exception of pneumonia. The doctor, our family doctor, actually said to her, she's a stubborn German woman who only goes to the doctor if she feels as though she's on her deathbed. And he said to her, if you waited another day, we might've lost you, you know? But the question is, where can you go from here? Like, where might you go from mm-hmm. here, from PJI? And, you know, I invite you to tell me more about that. We'll talk about mm-hmm. your clinical updates and PJI. I'm just wondering, like, where you can, because there are so many opportunities in infection, where you might take it from here.
Yeah. So, and this is, I think, reasonably easy to answer. And so we're, you know, we focused on
PJI. That's good, because it was an irrationally long question.
No. It was a really important question, because it comes back to the strategy about how we're building the company and how we're thinking about what we do go after, right? Because I think, again, if you look back to the class of molecules, they came on with all this promise of being the next penicillin, and so they could treat everything. Mm. And what we've really done is focus down on the indications and the disease types for the near term, where we think there's a real commercial opportunity, right? Because the challenge with antibiotics in general, and this probably won't be kind of news to anybody in this audience, is that antibiotic development is difficult. So some of the things that we talked about, you know, the typical ways that you would try to get these approved, HAPVAP, right? So pneumonia, UTI. We know, and there's evidence by multiple bankruptcies with approved products, mm-hmm. that there's just, we haven't figured out the commercial prospects for kind of broad antibiotics. Yeah. What we've really done is focus down and build a strategy around these infections that we can't treat currently. So the standard of antibiotics for PJI don't work, right? The reason we cut them out is because the normal drugs that we do have, the things that work everywhere else, don't work here. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about the near term, you know, we look at PJI, again, as I said, being the entry to the larger orthopedic infection problem, right? Because, again, when you get infections on kind of surfaces where there's not great blood flow, and the bugs grow in a certain way, and I don't want to necessarily go down that rabbit hole, but the reason antibiotics don't work on, you know, joint infections and it's harder on surfaces is because the bacteria grow in a way that makes them resistant to antibiotics. That doesn't apply to 206, and the reason we think it's so effective there is because it kills the bugs in a different way that allows it to be effective where others can't. And so in the near term, that's what we think about. So PJI, and then broaden that out as kind of the entry point into the broader orthopedic space. Hmm. Now, we do see opportunity. And so, you know, we're pursuing that path, not because there's clinical challenges for us that we anticipate. We haven't gone that far down, but we could do blood infections. We could do HAPVAP. We could do some of those things in the future. But until there's a clear pathway to reimbursement and commercial success, we're focused on where we think we can make a real impact for patients and be around long term.
We know that early stage biopharmas need support. Producing and scaling a biologic molecule is not easy. Companies with new or evolving programs need assistance every step of the way. Join us each week as we discuss all things emerging biotech, including regulatory, financing, and more. The Pod is brought to you in collaboration with Cytiva, a global provider of technologies and services that advance and accelerate the development, manufacture, and delivery of therapeutics, from idea to injection. Check out their resources at cytiva.com/emerging biotech. That's cytiva.com/emerging biotech.
What is that, the patient population? Do you have any, like, can you put a number to it? Like, or a, I don't know, what percentage of joint replacement surgeries end up in some sort of an infection scenario? Just generally.
Yeah. So PJI is an orphan disease. So we have orphan drug designation for that. So in the US, you know, you're looking at right now about 50,000 or so patients a year, 40 to 50,000 patients a year. Now they, like I mentioned, they have to go through multiple procedures. And so, you know, you're looking at kind of each individual patient has on average between 2 and 3 procedures to try to get to a resolution. Mm-hmm. And so the treatable population, or the procedure population, is a little bit bigger than that. But then as we look beyond PJI, you know, into other kind of orthopedic device infections and then orthopedic infections in general, the numbers increase, can increase pretty substantially from there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about the trajectory of the business's growth from its founding. So you started right out of your PhD. How long ago was that? When was the company founded?
Originally founded and so incorporated in 2013, really got off the ground in 2016 when we raised our first round of funding.
Yeah. So tell me about that. Like, what's your funding strategy looked like?
Yeah. So we originally built the company and we've maintained a reasonable capital efficiency relative to some of what you've seen, you know, in the, you say, the past 2 years, well, or 2020, 2021.
Right.
Maybe not 22.
But leading into the past 2 years, yeah. Right. Leading into
that's a fair way to categorize it. But so originally, so we're, you know, mostly equity-based funding. So, you know, we have investors. We have a pretty substantial non-dilutive base as well. So because we're an anti-infectives broadly, there's a group that is, I've been very supportive, called CARB-X, administered out of the University of Boston. But so they built the company, like I said, pretty capital efficiently through the end of 2020 till we got our first human data. So we had done a safety trial in Australia. Those data were good. And so then we started to expand both the programs and the company. And so we did a $35 million Series B round then. And now the company went from, you know, a handful of FTEs to about 25 people now.
Yeah. Oh, that's outstanding. And all 25, like, here in Pittsburgh, or are they dispersed?
So we're reasonably geographically dispersed. So we ended up hiring everybody during COVID.
Yeah.
And so we went with a talent first approach. And so, which has actually been useful because we're in a, you know, our POC trial is, we've got 12 sites around the US. It's actually been useful to have people kind of close by so that we can get to the different sites to be on site when the drug is administered.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. That's cool. How many people do you have here in Pittsburgh?
About half.
Half? Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. One of the things that I often talk with founders about is, like, you know, I think I have a pretty good picture of, like, why you started the company and why you're committed to it and what you're doing now. What can you share with us about, you know, the founder's mentality about
the end game for Jonathan Steckbeck and Peptologics? Like, you know, do you see yourself getting to a clinical point where you'd be happy to court a buyer or partner? Or do you see yourself wanting to see this thing through to commercialization and administration? Like what's sort of your...
Yeah. Look, I think...
To the degree that you're willing to answer that question.
Yeah, I think it's... You know, I didn't go work for a big company for a couple of reasons. One, I'm probably not well suited to it.
Why do you say that?
People who start companies probably aren't suited to working for somebody. aren't suited to working for somebody else, right?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you say that. A lot of the founders that I talk to... spend a lot of time in big pharma before they, you know, turn around and launch a company, you know, and maybe count that as good experience towards doing it. But
they probably also went through a more, without disparaging anyone, of course, went through a more linear path, a more traditional path.
Right.
No, but I think, you know, what we've been able to do with 206, right? I think the opportunity that we see there is, you know, for a disease where we just haven't been able to make any progress, we bring a unique, and we've tried to build the company. I've tried to build the company in a unique way to be able to address that disease problem, right? Because it's traditionally sat somewhere between med device and pharma, mm-hmm. right? Because if we cut it out, that means the surgeon's doing it, and we have all these mechanical fixes to try to fix it. Pharma sees the problem, but don't really know how to deal with surgeons, right? That's been, I think, one of the big challenges traditionally. And so what I've done is tried to bring together a team that can see where the unique pieces are and kind of build that middle ground, build mm-hmm. that bridge between them to, you know, be able to address the right kind of user population, but do it with a drug.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a really unique opportunity to be able to commercialize that. And then if you kind of on the back of that with the computational approach, you know, kind of the long game there is if we solve some of the challenges that we're working to solve and we can really encode activity into molecules, what that should do is make the process a lot more efficient, right? Give each kind of program a higher probability of success. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what happens in other areas where you use these kind of recursively improving technologies, right, they get better and better the more you use them. The natural kind of endpoint for that is that you can design molecules for not just a specific disease, but for a person's disease, kind of on the fly. If we can do that with a high enough fidelity, a high enough kind of accuracy, probability of success, we bring the cost way down. And so we can then treat more diseases and, you know, kind of do it with better access, right? Because it shouldn't then be as expensive as it has been. And so you change the cost curve for development.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's more often than not now, just in the last few years. So this podcast, I think we're like into year three. I think we just celebrated our third anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. In the beginning, it seemed, and this is just 3 years ago, like very recent history. More often than not, I would speak with companies who are purely developers of, you know, biologic therapeutics. More recently, it's far more common to talk with companies who are developing biologic therapeutics, have a pipeline, have candidates in the clinic, but also have a little platform gig going on, or vice versa. Like the platform is the gig and they're using that they're using their clinical activity, their candidates to prove out their platform gig. So I'm kind of getting that sense, like your molecular design intentions are obviously tightly related to 206, mm-hmm. but also there's another opportunity there. Mm-hmm. Like which would you say is sort of the lead horse in the race right now? Can you answer that?
That's a tough one to answer, frankly, just because I think the opportunity space with both is so unique mm-hmm. that I work really hard to not have a favorite child.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I like that.
I want to talk a little bit about doing business in Pennsylvania. I love Pittsburgh. I love coming down here and recording with people in Pittsburgh, and I'm always excited to learn about a new therapeutics developer in Pittsburgh. And I understand you're a PA, not a Pittsburgh guy, but a PA guy.
Correct.
Lancaster. Mm-hmm. Lancaster? Scranton.
Ish. Hershey-ish.
Hershey. Okay.
In that general...
Everything's ish.
Yes, in that general area.
You get into central Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so for the audience, the Hershey area will be the thing that resonates the most.
Hershey, yeah. Yeah, the chocolate. Yep. And then you went to Penn State.
Correct.
University Park?
Yep.
Maine? Yeah, yes. My son's going there in the fall. Engineering. So
nice.
Yeah, he'll be a freshman there. And then Pitt. Why did you stay in Pittsburgh? Like, this is a space, obviously, where Philly and Silicon Valley and Boston are super hot spots. So why'd you stay here?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of reasons. So one is it's home. Two is that given the things that we're doing, right? Drug development and kind of the computational piece, there's a natural reason to be here, right? When I moved to Pittsburgh, one of the things that I really liked about it and that I, has really been something that resonated and I thought was unique here was that, if you think about, there aren't a whole lot of cities in the world, let alone the country, where you have a concentration of life sciences talent, right? So you look at the University of Pittsburgh, you look at the UPMC, CMU to a certain extent. Right next to one of the world's greatest kind of engineering and computational schools in CMU.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think long term, if we're going to continue to make the same kinds of gains in medicine that we have over the last 50 years, we're going to need to figure out how to use those things together.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that's the ability to do that here is as good as anywhere. It's also, a nice place to live. It's a cheaper place to do business. I think, we have less concern than you might in Boston or South San Francisco for, talent poaching, I guess, if you will,
from
a pure business standpoint.
Yeah.
It's a good place to be.
Yeah. I should have asked this question earlier when we were talking about 206 and patients and administration. You mentioned, that it addresses an issue that kind of grazed the line between med device and therapeutic and pharma. And you mentioned that Pittsburgh, is great for Pittsburgh. It's got a good med device engineering background as well, growing, I think, therapeutics community. And then obviously the computational part super strong. Do these all come together and play in any specific way to the administration of 206? Is there an administration, approach that blurs those lines as well? Or is it a parental sort of?
No, yeah, it's.
I should have asked this a while ago.
It's very procedural, right? Mm-hmm. And so, it's not because I think one of the reason the typical drugs don't work, or part of the reason they don't work, is also you just can't get enough there through typical means, right? So whether you take a bunch of antibiotics by mouth, orally, or a parenteral administration, an IV administration, you just can't get enough to the site.
Yeah,
and so what we're doing is understanding that given this is a surgical problem, the bar for trying to do something different initially would be very high. And so what we're doing is a perisurgical application. So when the surgeon goes in to treat the disease, treat the PJI, we're just giving him something effective to do that with. Because right now what they do basically, you can try to do this pretty quickly, is what they'd like to do is just kind of reopen the joint, just surgically reopen it, cut away the infected tissue, and then just wash off the device. That doesn't work more than 50% of the time because, they've tried pretty much anything you can think of to wash it off. High concentrations of antibiotics, alcohols, peroxides, none of that works. And so they just essentially use betadine, povidone iodine.
Yeah.
Not terribly effective. We look at 206 based on its activity characteristics, the way that it works. It's effective as that kind of wash solution. So it gives them in the procedure they already do and they already know and are going to do anyway, it now gives them an effective tool to actually clean off that device. The implications of that downstream are when those things fail, what has to happen is that now we take everything out, right? So you go in for one major surgery to have it kind of cleaned out. If that fails, you've got to go in for another one. And now they're taking all the hardware out, put in like a temporary kind of spacer that lets you move around a little bit, ideally. And if that works, like if it looks like they cleared the infection, now you've got to come back for a third surgery to have new hardware put in.
Yeah.
And so as a consequence of that first thing not working, you're committing to, you know, multiple major surgeries. And then we get into that cycle we talked about early on, which is just major, you know, major surgery after major surgery is just hard on the body.
Yeah.
Especially in the populations that we're talking about.
Yeah.
So we look at 206, if we administer it in that first thing where we can keep the hardware, if we can clean it off, get it nice and clean, then we don't have to go to those other major surgeries.
Yeah.
And that'll be better outcomes for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad I asked. I'm glad I asked. Like I said, I should have asked that a while ago. Your involvement, getting back to the Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh connection, your involvement in the community here, the life sciences community in Pittsburgh is, I think, marked by a board membership at Life Sciences PA, for example. So one, tell me why you committed to that position, and two, what the, I guess, kind of, you know, when I'm in Boston, you can't bump into a founder without, you know, talking about 16 other founders on the same block, right? In biotech. What is that kind of peer founder community here like? And how has it changed, I think, over the course of time that you've been here?
Yeah. So I guess that, you know, again, starting with that one, I think that the biotech community here is, you know, I can't with a straight face say that it's going to rival Boston or sure. San Francisco,
yeah.
But it's stronger than I've ever seen it. And I've been here, you know, more than 20 years now. It is continually growing. And I think we have the right momentum, right? And so that's getting better. Now, as to why, you know, why LSPA, why, you know, do some of these things, being, you know, from Pennsylvania and then, you know, kind of moving here 20 or more years ago, there, if you kind of think historically, in the kind of Industrial Revolution, Pittsburgh was the center of innovation, right? The country was built here, like quite literally.
Yeah.
Right. Oil discovered here, steel for the railroads, right? Everything was actually.
Well, now hang on. I live in Crawford County. I don't know how familiar you are with 79 North, but I live in Crawford County. My mom and dad live in Cherry Tree, which is like directly adjacent to Titusville.
Titusville,
City region. They lay claim to the oil.
Sure. Western Pennsylvania. Okay, all right, Pennsylvania broadly, right?
That's kind of ground there.
It's kind of, but just as with Pittsburgh as its center, right?
Because
I think, yes, those things were true. I mean, we don't want to give credit to Cleveland, right? Because a lot of the stuff went west.
No, Ohio, no.
My wife's from Ohio. I actually really like Ohio, being inclusive. But I think, you know, this used to be one of the most, most important areas of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of the raw materials are here for that to be again, because if the next, it's called the next, I hate to say Industrial Revolution, right? Because it just sounds weird.
Yeah.
But the next big kind of important industries are going to be around healthcare and kind of artificial intelligence broadly. And if we can bring those two things together, you know, what I'd like to do is help this area kind of recognize or kind of reach its potential.
Yeah. 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 There is a lot of technology. I think it was Michael Hufford at Ligenesis here in Pittsburgh, who I interviewed not too long ago. And he told me, he gave me a little known fact, fun fact about Pittsburgh that I didn't realize is that the first autonomous vehicles were driving around Pittsburgh like before anybody was talking about it. That was news to me. You know,
it's pretty cool. I think CMU used to win that competition every year.
Yeah, pretty wild.
And then Uber started there. You used to be able to hail a driverless Uber.
So we're running short on time here, Dr. Steckbeck. But I guess the two final questions I have for you: one would be what have I not asked you that I should have? Big picture.
And then two, give us an update on 206 and any other pipeline updates that are relevant.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I don't think we omitted anything.
What about any updates on the molecular design initiative? Next steps for that?
We continue to, I will say we've made considerable progress on a lot of the technical aspects of that and are now starting to look toward working with other folks on that.
Good deal. All right. So those of you listening, Peptologix might be ready for some partnership coming down the pike here.
We have some conversations ongoing, I guess I can say.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll look for an update for that down the road. And I appreciate the invitation to come down here and spend time with you guys.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. We'll do it again. We'll do it again when there's more to report on.
We will.
Sounds
looking
good.
Forward to it.
All right. That's Peptologix founder and CEO, Dr. Jonathan Steckbeck. I'm Matt Piller, and this is The Business of Biotech. We're produced by Bioprocess Online, part of the Life Science Connect community, in partnership with Cytiva, who you can learn more about at cytiva.com/emerging biotech. Then head over to bioprocessonline.com/BOB, where you can subscribe to a newsletter built exclusively for Business of Biotech listeners. You should also subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already. We'll drop a fresh episode on Monday. And in the meantime, I thank you for listening.